And so they sat down, and then they started saying, "We've been watching you closely." And I said to him, "What's the reason? Why am I being watched so closely? I must be special if you've been watching me closely."
Operatives involved in the hunt for Jihadi John have not spoken publicly.
"This is James Rightful, an American citizen of your country."
The Foley video, partly the image, but even more the voice of his captor, was really shocking because it was so clearly a British London accent.
The way that Jihadi John spoke into the camera, his demeanor, his accent, we'd never seen anything like this before.
We then had a race to find out who he was. His size, his hands, but above all his voice made identifying him quite easy.
It was very distinctive, and within hours we had a name for that individual, Mohammed Emwazi.
"You're no longer fighting an insurgency. We are an Islamic army and a state."
"You saw a masked man with a knife, and he sent this message that the Islamic State was here. It was not Al-Qaeda. Everyone knew about Al-Qaeda, but ISIS, al-Baghdadi, these guys were different. They were this new brand."
So the net slowly, slowly begins to tighten. Mohammed Emwazi, he knows that we're coming after him. He went to great lengths to prevent being captured. You know, he didn't want to get captured. He didn't want to get killed.
How did you go from this conservative, sports-loving teenager to somebody who's splashed with the arterial blood of the men he's beheading? This is not just a subtle transformation. This is literally going from nothing to everything with little in between.
Surveillance footage with locations and faces circled, a photo of a young boy followed by another of a grown man in a black face mask. Syria and Iraq are highlighted on a map, then photos of members of ISIS and an aerial view of vehicles speeding across a vast stretch of desert. Explosions followed by clouds of thick smoke billowing skyward. The hunt for Jihadi John. Hashtag hunt for Jihadi John. A photo of a young boy in a red school uniform.
Mohammed Emwazi, he had an interesting journey, but not one that's particularly different to other people. He started off in Kuwait, where his family were a persecuted minority. They were known as the Badoun tribe.
So the Emwazis, with little Mohammed, 1993, when he was about 6 years old, packed their bags and headed for London.
And they were then subsequently given asylum in the UK.
They moved into a small flat in Maida Vale, and they began to build a family.
And Emwazi spent his life growing up as someone whose family had to leave their home country because of their identity, and then subsequently trying to figure out how he fits into this new society in the heart of the UK.
He supported Manchester United, but he also liked pop groups like S Club 7. In his yearbook at primary school, he said his big dream was to be a Manchester United football player.
Joe Shooter, head teacher.
Mohammed was in year 10 when I started as head. He wasn't a particularly noticeable young person.
I met Mohammed through teaching English for about a year. So I didn't teach him for very long, but the family I grew to know really well because his younger sister was then in my next year group. He wasn't vocal. He wasn't particularly aggressive. He was just a kind of, like a passenger. I always see Mohammed as like a passenger. He was much more of a follower than he was a leader.
He kind of hunched and tried to make eye contact with me, found that difficult. He often walked around covering his mouth, and sometimes some young boys would tease him about his breath. But that was, I think it was more of an insecurity for him.
If kids started baiting him about his breath, he'd react. They'd start ganging up on him, and they knew which buttons to press with him, was it? It just shows how kind of vulnerable he was.
On the playing field where the boys would play football, I remember one time I confiscated the ball because, you know, I was being hit every second. At one point, Mohammed was nearby and I kind of looked at him. Wasn't me, miss. I said, okay, just move on. He wasn't argumentative. He wasn't rude. He wasn't aggressive. He just was very pliable. He just would... me.
As they sit in front of a computer, a school friend asks Emwazi, "Are you starting again?" He replies, "No." His friend asks, "Have you finished every level?" Emwazi laughs and answers, "What do you think?"
The few occasions I would take the class into the computer room, Muhammad would gravitate to those computers. He would love to be in the computer room. And it's almost like he came alive when he was in front of a screen.
Footage of Emwazi at school, staring at the computer screen. A panoramic view of houses and high-rise blocks beneath brooding clouds. Underground and overground trains and cars speeding along. Then a gang of three youths walking together at night.
As he progresses through his teenage years, he's drinking, his friends say he loves clubbing, he's smoking cannabis. He's got a reputation for being a bit of a party animal.
A lone figure walking.
So my perception of him once he got into the sixth form, and he obviously he wanted to go to university, but he did become less willing to fit in. The level of defiance in him grew. And I remember occasions when he was asked to leave lessons because he just wasn't working.
Some of his older friends in the community are part of street gangs. This is another theme in Wazir's life. He's very much influenced by older men. So all key figures in his life tend to be people who he can look up to. And some of the gang members were involved in crime. One or two served jail terms for stealing bikes, drugs offences. And Wazi himself was arrested and put on trial for a string of bike robberies. He was eventually acquitted of that. But by association, he was being drawn into this kind of crime lifestyle.
Jesse Morton, convicted recruiter.
There are similarities between a criminal lifestyle and recruitment for jihad. So everybody's looking for a sense of purpose, meaning, and significance in life, right? And the jihadist milieu presents itself as a David versus Goliath mentality for those that are disenfranchised. We give a family to those that never had a family before. We present Islam as an ability to transform that into something powerful and positive. It gives structure where there was none. It is a major tool for recruitment because you're selling a complete lifestyle in the same way that a gang sells a complete countercultural lifestyle. You're selling a countercultural gang-like lifestyle. And so the two correlate rather well.
Commander Richard Wharton, Scotland Yard.
So he started in 2006 at Westminster University, a normal teenage lad with normal aspirations. But something happened over the intervening 3 years.
We'd had reporting on him during some of his later university years that he was becoming more extreme.
It's likely the strongest influence on Emwazi over that time were two specific individuals.
Mohamed Saka, who had also been to the same school, but 3 years older than Emwazi, had already been to Kenya. He'd been arrested. He had lots of stories to tell about how he was leading this really exciting life. As charismatic as Saka was, his friend, a guy called Bilal Bajawi, he'd also been to Kenya. He'd been arrested. He'd been accused of being involved in terrorism. He had double the charisma, he had double the stories.
And it's become increasingly apparent that radicalization isn't something for lonely people. There's a strong social process that happens. What started off as him just being a difficult teenager doing lots of delinquent activity to becoming actually someone who wanted to redeem himself and return back to his original Islamic identity and practice it more wholly.
He was part of a very supportive, inclusive school environment. And going on to university, a lot of those kinds of support structures are withdrawn. And I think that for any vulnerable young person, being part of a very big, faceless university community is where some of those issues would have set in.
Emwazi walks past Joe in the corridor.
Like we've said, he was one of those invisible young people that we assume everything's okay. And in hindsight, it obviously wasn't.
A young Emwazi sitting at the computer with his head resting on his hand. Hashtag hunt for Jihadi John. Robert Vercake.
Having left the university in 2009, they cast their eyes around the world and the region they land on is Somalia, because Somalia is in the grip of an Islamic revolution. Somalia was the only jihad in town, as far as they were concerned.
A large gathering of armed jihadis with red headbands.
March 2009, Nwazi teamed up with a couple of friends and they set off to Tanzania, where they said they were going to go on safari.
Planes on runways, people walking through an airport, and a large bank of monitors.
I know, and we know, we were running operations against West London Islamists at the time, and we were fully aware of their intentions, which were not to go to a safari.
Gliding over the bustling city of Dar es Salaam in Tanzania.
When they arrived in Dar es Salaam, they were greeted by the Tanzanian security services. They were locked up for the night, subject to beatings, generally roughed up, you might say. And we know all this because of Mwazi's own account of what happened to him.
On the way back to the airplane, Emmanuel came to us and we said, "Look, tell us the reason why we've been rejected." He told us, "It's not the Tanzanian government, it could be the British government. That's the reason they haven't let you in." So we're in a major shock.
They went back via Amsterdam. When they arrived in Amsterdam, they were met again by security service officers from both the Dutch security service and MI5.
Sat me down and they said, "We think you're a person that wants to go to Somalia to do some terrorist activities." I told them, "Look, man, Tanzania's here. Somalia's all the way over there. You'd have to go past Kenya." And I told them, you've probably got this messed up now, yeah?
Dover.
He was quizzed in Amsterdam for 12 or so hours. On his return to Dover, he was further questioned by British security services.
We made approaches to him and we wanted to give him the opportunity to work for us and to actually desist from becoming a terrorist.
And so they sat down and then he said, "Well, Mohammed, we went to your house, we spoke to your mother and father." I told him, "You've got no right to do that, you know."
They rammed home this idea that life could become uncomfortable for him. Unless, of course, he wanted to cooperate with them. Perhaps let us know what some of your friends are up to. To Nwazi, this was a red rag to a bull. This is not something that he's prepared to do. It's an ultimate betrayal of everything that he has become.
They went through my bag, and then I had one jacket, it's a proper safari jacket, and he said, "This looks a bit military, Mohammed." And I just laughed at him. I said, "How can you suggest that this is military?" I told him, "What about this other jumper? I had another jumper, the stylish Rockaway jumper. Why don't you say something about this?" They just threw it at me and told me, "All right, you can put your stuff back inside your bag and off you go, mate."
The challenge for the service in the context of Jihadi John is understanding how his mental state is evolving. If there's any suggestion at all that it may have the opposite effect, then the recruitment ought not to take place.
There's always a risk when you make these approaches, and the chances of success are, in any event, fairly minimal. But you can't not do them. You have to give an individual an opportunity to not go down that path.
But we've got to be careful. There's a kind of nature-nurture debate within that. Was he always likely to carry out that kind of activity, or did he carry out that activity just because he was approached? I think it's unlikely that was the turning point.
And Nwazi now had something to tell his friends. He'd been stopped by the cops. He'd been insulted, he would say, by the security services. He'd received a beating in Tanzania. You can imagine how proud he was. He'd come of age. He was a serious jihadi player now.
A lone figure on a high-rise balcony. Douglas H. Wise, CIA.
If you try to look at the physical origins of the Islamic State as a fighting force, the seeds were sown in places like Camp Buka.
"This is a new front line in the fight against terrorism. Camp Buka, the United States' biggest detention facility in Iraq. Inside Camp Buka, there are more than 19,000 civilian detainees. They are neither criminals nor prisoners of war."
A detainee personnel record.
There's a significant amount of mystery about Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi and the circumstances of his life that ultimately resulted in him being incarcerated in Camp Buka. He knew that the best way for him to survive in that camp was to take on the persona
of a senior respected individual in the camp community by gaining the trust of the U.S. military.
When I took over command of the Surge as a four-star in early 2007, it was quickly apparent to me that this was almost a terrorist training university. We had failed to remove the true extremists from the midst of the population, where they were proselytizing and essentially running these particular areas.
These are all Al-Qaeda, but this is not a place that you want to hang around. So we really don't want to stand here that much longer because they will now organize around us. And you can already see the lieutenants ready to move.
If we go back this way, I'll take it.
Look at them. Look at them put two together.
They are watching. I mean, when I'm looking at them here, it's just like they're watching really, really carefully.
Yeah, notice how, because they're a collective society, they are thinking on groups of three together. To five with somebody else standing behind, asking them to ask the question so he doesn't get identified. Inside a compound like this, there are leaders. We don't know yet who they are.
Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi clearly understood, not being a warrior himself, that he could, in fact, lead and manage warriors. So this was the laboratory in which his culture was grown.
You had an alienated group of Iraqi officers mixing with some extremist elements that were already there. The two came together in a sort of symbiotic way that over time, because this didn't happen overnight, a lot of these relationships were formed but didn't flourish for a number of years until suddenly there was a marriage of convenience and they fired each other up.
When he was released for good behavior from Camp Buka, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi hid literally in plain sight. He used that time frame to exploit the relationships that he had made in the camp and consolidate his infrastructure and ultimately put him in a position to declare the existence of the Islamic State.
Lots of people were surprised at the speed at which ISIS took charge of territory in Syria and Iraq.
What Baghdadi built in Syria swept back into Western Iraq.
This was a terrorist army, and they spread through Iraq really like a cancer, and they moved through the Sunni portions of Iraq. They got dangerously close to Baghdad.
The Iraqi government is losing control.
This is happening with unbelievable speed. The violent Islamic group has launched something of an invasion.
A Sunni Islamic terror group formed last year after being expelled from Al-Qaeda for being too radical. But who are they? They're the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, ISIS for short.
The latest reports are that police forces in Mosul were taking off their uniforms, laying down their guns, and leaving.
So this ragtag organization that were able to occupy places like Mosul and appear to defend them would have been very vulnerable to a Western force. Can you imagine what the American army would have done to them? But there was no political appetite to do it.
It had shamed the Iraqi army, and it also showed the combat and military prowess of the Islamic State.
Groups like ISIS are effectively using medieval warfare ethics. Of course, human society has moved on in the ensuing centuries, and now we don't kill prisoners and we don't take slaves.
A man says, today is the female slave market day. It's distribution day. Another says, with the permission of Allah, everyone gets a share. I hope a jihadi will give me one as a gift. Then a third asks, hey you, where's my Yazidi girl?
But for ISIS, they reject modern convention. They're trying to stick literal interpretations of texts from the 7th and 8th centuries. So this is why this is a battle for the heart and soul of Islam.
And it was a message to the Western world that the Islamic State was an enterprise to be reckoned with. So it wasn't just a military capability that was made in promise. Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi actually cashed that check that he wrote.
Glowing headlights.
In May 2009, Mohammed Mwazi has been through quite an ordeal. When he finally gets back to London, still smarting from the indignities of the interrogations and detentions, he then discovers that his fiancée's family have received a visit from the security services.
He said to me, we spoke to a certain person. This person I was going to get married to, and I told them, how on earth do you know about this person?
They even said the name, because obviously the only way
they can find out about that is through listening to my phone conversations. He laughed and shrugged his shoulders and said, yeah, well, it's our job.
So his fiancée was approached, and of course she was then deterred, if you like. She then walks away from him.
For them, who are a very conservative Somali family, this is a problem. Not only have they messed with his own life, they've messed with his girlfriend's life.
But what you have with individuals like this, you have an emerging intelligence picture based on intelligence that you're receiving from individuals that are associating with them, who are working for us. And they're telling us that he's becoming more hardline, more extremist, and more of a threat.
You know, while he's being stopped when he goes out, questioned, he's being followed, he's having to get involved in counter-surveillance activities. So he's sort of jumping on trains at the last minute, he's leaving his mobile phone at home, he's meeting in parks with associates. I mean, he's looking very suspicious.
As a young Muslim on the fringes of extremist activities, he was a legitimate target. In fact, the service would have been failing in its duty if it didn't keep him under some kind of observation.
And whilst his family were concerned about their oldest son, his younger brother Omar, who I met and who told me that the family hatched a plan where he would travel to Kuwait, stay with his grandmother, and he would escape not just the attention of security services, but also the influence of the gang that he was running with. And that's what he did. He took a job with a computer company where the boss thought he was an excellent worker. He'd met another girlfriend, someone who he also wanted to marry. He was enjoying his new life. Unfortunately, Mwazi has problems with his teeth. He tries Kuwaiti dentist, but none of them can solve his severe toothache. He can't sleep. So he speaks to his family and they say, come back.
Once an individual knows that they are under the scrutiny of the state, they then have to develop, if you like, cover stories for their activity.
I would only say that what we don't know is what else he's doing in Kuwait. All we know is that he's coming back and forth. So he comes back for the second time.
Of course, raising again the suspicion of the authorities that he was not content with his life in Kuwait.
He turns up at Heathrow Airport a few days later. This time, he's detained in the airport.
According to his father, he's prevented from going back to Kuwait, not by the Kuwaiti intelligence services, but by British pressure on Kuwaiti intelligence services.
Would it be a legitimate use of the security services' powers to invite another state to decline a visa? Possibly. But it's equally as plausible that the Kuwaiti government just didn't want him in the country.
Unfortunately, he learns while he's in London that Kuwaiti security services have visited his Kuwaiti fiancée's family. They have introduced the idea that he may be linked to terrorism. Again, the family call the wedding off. His whole life is being, as far as he's concerned, funneled in one direction. Can't go to Kuwait, finding it impossible to exist in London. His attentions are now focused on extreme lifestyle, the full jihad.
The extent to which you can suppress and disrupt an individual's activities in the country that they're in, and the extent to which you should give them freedom to travel, is a massively complex issue for intelligence agencies around the world.
At some point in 2012, Mohamed Mwazi managed to slip out of the country. Perhaps he joined a convoy with other friends. We're not entirely sure who he went with.
So what we'd hoped to stop came to pass. In a sense, all we did was held back the inevitable. Whether we contributed to his further radicalization and his clear anger and vitriol against the British state by stopping him from travel is an interesting question.
The Syrian government forces continue to bombard Aleppo, beating back rebels of the Free Syrian Army. But the battle for the country's largest city is also taking a deadly toll on civilians. The regime has bombed hospitals, homes, even people standing in line for bread.
I guess the biggest, most obvious silence was Thanksgiving of 2012. Jim was always very cognizant of holidays or birthdays and certainly Thanksgiving. To not hear from him was odd. And so we were a bit concerned. And it actually was the next morning, the morning after Thanksgiving, when one of his colleagues called to tell us that he had been captured. So that confirmed our fear.
A photo of journalist James Foley standing on a dirt track bordered by dry stone walls.
Raqqa was taken 6 weeks or so before I arrived in the city, and I wanted to do mostly political reporting. We entered the former headquarters of the Baath Party. Following day, we came back to their headquarters, and they just abducted us in the street. That was a trap. And they drove me for about 20 minutes. When they removed the blindfold, I was in a bathroom. Then they locked the door.
More than 70,000 Syrian refugees have flooded into Turkey the past 24 hours, and that number could grow to more than 100,000.
I was working for an organization called Impact Initiative, so we were doing the humanitarian data assessment, providing data that would inform humanitarian programming. David was a big guy. When you first meet him, you're sort of someone who inspires confidence when you're going into places. He was a wonderful guy. We had very similar ideas as to the good and the bad of what we were doing. I think we connected really quickly and sort of felt comfortable around each other. We spent the Saturday, Sunday primarily in IDP camps, moving around. And also for me, it was the first time that I was in Syria. The 12th of March, I think, was a Tuesday. We had gone in the morning, and we went to a town, a small town called Ataret. And on our way back, I was on the phone with my boss in Geneva. And at one stage, we passed two black cars. I mean, we're on a dirt track, and we got to a junction where the road sort of widened and became more normal road, I guess. And that's where these cars who had been now behind us, sort of one of them overtook.
Headlights pierce the dark as a car overtakes a truck on a desolate stretch of road.
They blocked us out, and these masked fighters jumped out, surrounded the car. I actually dropped the phone with my boss still on the line. I managed to say to him that we were getting kidnapped, that we had a problem. It all happened very, very quickly. I just have, like, flash recollections.
They're taken from the truck and tied up by the armed, masked men.
I just remember the car face down on the ground in the boot. David was put in just before me. It just happened in a flash. The next thing you know, we're speeding away very, very fast.
A photo of David Haynes standing beside his daughter, Bethany.
On my 16th birthday, I was actually in France with some friends. My dad would always contact me on my birthday, no matter where he was. And it got later on at night and I thought, something's not right. And I started to get a sinking feeling. So I phoned my mum quite upset and I said to her, look, I've got a really bad feeling. You need to find out what's happened. My head automatically assumed the worst. So when she said he was kidnapped, it was actually a part of a relief to find out that he hadn't been killed. But of course, your mind goes everywhere. I thought, why would someone kidnap someone who was only there to help?
A dusty city full of war-torn buildings.
So Emwazi finds a way out to the new frontier, to the new global jihad in Syria, and very quickly finds a new mentor, a Chechenian warlord called Shishani, who was leading the group called KAM within Syria. And it was really a breakaway group from Al-Qaeda or Al-Nusra Front.
Shishani, a man who had war experience in Chechnya, had developed a brutal reputation for committing atrocities, but who saw in Emwazi someone who would follow orders to the letter.
Who would carry out almost any brutal act if directed to do so. And Emwazi became quite well known and reliable, if you like, to the leadership of this new group.
Battalion of Mujahideen, migrants, we ask God Almighty to comfort us by uniting all the ranks.
Kitab al-Mujahideen had become slightly fractured. Half the group was aligned with Al-Qaeda, and the other half, led by Shishani, were more interested in making links with the emerging Islamic State as is now. And Shishani decided that he would take his group to join the Islamic State. and with him, Mohammed Emwazi followed.
Once within Islamic State, Emwazi and Shoshani are led by the Emir of Aleppo, Amr al-Absi. Al-Absi is a seasoned terrorist and a close confidant of the ISIS leader, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. Under the guidance of Al-Absi, Emwazi and Shoshani, along with some UK recruits, Alexander Coty, Ain Davis and Al-Shafi al-Sheikh, started a mass hostage-taking campaign all across northern Syria. And with that, they captured hundreds of Syrian prisoners, but they also captured a very important group of Western hostages.
The Islamic State emirs felt that because of his loyalty and because of his willingness to carry out acts of brutality without question, Emwazi would be perfect for this, and perhaps they were right.
So Emwazi, this career jihadist, has moved through the ranks. He graduates effectively, suddenly with the opportunity to actually fulfill his dreams as a proper global jihadi.
A photograph of Emwazi posing with an assault rifle. Hostages are marched across a compound.
The faces of most of our guards, we haven't seen them. The funny thing is that we nickname them. It's a kind of coping mechanism, that there is something that you don't control, you bad guard. It is the names that I give to you. And this, you will never control it. The most common names that were known through the media were, of course, the Beatles.
The guys that we've nicknamed the Beatles were British-born, native British accents. And they were the first people that conversed with us in the car. When they'd taken our passports, they sort of, I think the very first thing was when they said, "David, welcome to Syria, you mutt," something like that. And sort of, because I think they'd looked through his passport, and then they'd asked David if I spoke any English.
So they actually kidnapped you?
Yeah. And so they reappeared and reappeared throughout that first month.
So the Beatles were three obviously British hostage takers. We understood that they probably were friends even before arriving to Syria, because they were very close. They were not always together, but most of the time at least two of them would come together. John was the boss. He was the one giving orders to the others. He was the one in charge of collecting the proofs of lives. George was a punisher. He was the most violent in the group. And yeah, I remember his fat hands. And the third one was Ringo. Ringo was the preacher. The less violent of these three, the one who would, from time to time, explain to us why they were doing that.
Mozzie was in control of what happened. I mean, he initiated and allowed a lot of our punishment, and he was very much involved. He also sort of set the tone for the guards. They took a lot of their inspiration from what they had heard about places like Abu Ghraib and what the coalition forces in other countries had done. Guantanamo was referenced all the time by Emwazi in particular. But the orange materials at various stages, we were wearing jumpsuits, all of us. And so things like stress positions and not allowing us to sleep or just stand up all night, you know, things like that.
Some of us received much more violence than others, and that was for reasons that I couldn't understand.
We knew that there were another two captives in the same location. You could hear their screams, they could hear ours, and eventually we met them. It was James Foley and John Cantley. And they put us into a cell to do a Royal Rumble, basically get us to fight against each other. The cell that John and James were in, because the ceiling was so high, at the top it had a latch, and they were watching from above. And so they had Dave and me in one corner and John and James on the other, and they wanted us to fight. And we were like, we obviously weren't going to fight each other, but you kind of couldn't not fight. I mean, there was potential for punishment. I remember we sort of went through the motions initially, realized we couldn't, because they were saying, if you don't start, you know, and you have to, we were like skeletons. by then. I think every one of us fainted at some stage or another just from exhaustion. So we weren't exactly hurting each other. But they found it highly entertaining.
5th of July 2014, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, the leader of ISIS.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Addressing a mosque full of followers, he says, "Praise the Prophet and his followers and his soldiers. They've rushed to declare an Islamic caliphate and to appoint an imam."
Baghdadi has this extraordinary vision, however twisted the ideology, however twisted the interpretation of Islam, however extreme the actions, but he does something truly extraordinary.
Propaganda was directed to idealistic people who wanted to live in the perfect state and who had learnt since their childhood about this wonderful idea of the caliphate, which a lot of Muslims very much cherish, including Muslims who would have not the slightest sympathy with the likes of ISIS.
I think it's like grooming, and even worse than that, because they are promising them and telling them, this is not us. We are just passing the message of God. This is an order from God. Here is the Quranic verse telling you that you should go, you should migrate to the caliphate. You should leave the land of Kufar, which is Britain, and you go to the caliphate.
There was a lot of talk around the fact that there was an Islamic state now, that we were prisoners of a state, therefore there were rules.
Some of the proofs of lies were obtained in a neighboring room. Jihadi Dran would then be the one directing the filming. So it would give us the instructions, okay, you arrive this side, you sit there, you say that, and then you stand up and leave the frame, and it would stand next to the camera, and there will be another beetle behind the camera, pressing the button.
We received an email from his captors. They asked for proof of life questions so they could assure us they had Jim. And we were very excited to hear from them.
I mean, of course, there was the proofs of life were like the one thing that sort of sent, well, there's obviously something going on. I mean, we all were aware of various government positions on this issue.
Well, we don't negotiate with terrorists or pay ransoms or pursue those kinds of activities because it just begets more terrorism. It encourages more actions. But of course, it's a very difficult policy to explain to the loved ones of someone who has been kidnapped. And of course, the overall policy objective, I think even they can understand why. But of course, they want an exception in their case.
We were back and forth on email for about a month, till the end of December, and then they cut off all communication after that. So it was kind of a tease, if you will.
Dave and I always sort of, we always believed that because we were taken together, there was a good chance that we would be negotiated for together. And then the moment that you realized, that I realized, through that sort of final proof of life process, that this was only for me. It's probably one of the most bittersweet emotions I think I've ever had.
When they eventually came to the room and said, "Okay, the four French here, come and we blindfold, handcuffs, and we take you out," it was like I just had time to say, "Well, goodbye, everybody." We had no time for big hugs or whatever.
For some reason, the day that I was picked up, the beetles were super aggressive. Gave me a beating, but then they took it out on everyone around as well. And just before they put the blanket over my head, they made me go back to the door and sort of say goodbye to your friends or something like that.
Normally, when you are taken hostage, once you are released, you're free. But in our case, when we were released, we left 15 pals behind us.
You know, these guys aren't just people or friends. They're brothers. And I think I spent more time sleeping next to David than any girl at that point in my life.
A helicopter lands. Then the released hostages step out onto the tarmac.
We were very hopeful when the Spanish hostages were released in February. Shortly thereafter, the French were released and, you know, and so we were incredibly hopeful. They told us that Jim was alive and well and strong and were very encouraging. And I actually returned to France in July of 2014, hoping to get some help from France. And it was while I was in Paris that we received the threatening email, threatening to kill Jim. I was hopeful they were back in touch, but again, I was very naive. I don't know if they ever desired to negotiate. It's hard to know, but certainly not at that hour. They weren't. I think they had come to realize that Jim was worth more as propaganda.
A message to America. James Foley kneels on the ground beside Mwazi, who's wearing dark clothes and a face mask.
I call on my friends, family, and loved ones to rise up against my real killers, the U.S. government.
19th of August, 2014. Diane Foley, James's mother.
I was totally unaware of it until an AP reporter called me sobbing. And, you know, I couldn't even understand what she was crying about. And she told me to look on Twitter. So that's when I saw the image, and I knew it was Jim, and that's how I found out. I didn't know if it was authentic, and so I reached out to our FBI agent, but really didn't hear back from anybody. So I didn't know if it was true until the president announced it that evening on TV. So it was, you know, it was awful. You know, it was really very difficult.
Federico Motka.
The last time I saw James and David and a lot of the others was when the videos came out.
And then the message to America, I was to say, I don't like to use their words. I like to be precise and factual. That was a filmed murder. That's it.
He takes a moment.
Of an innocent journalist. Of a hostage.
And then once the first one came out, you sort of, you know, there was the threat of the second, the next.
2nd of September 2014, Mwazi, holding a knife, addresses a camera while another man kneels beside him. Stephen Sotloff, 1983 to 2014.
So then after that, you're just, will it, won't it? And then...
David was a very complex and interesting character. Very smart. Very good at understanding people. Very supportive also.
Generally, we're all very close as a group, but of course everyone has maybe one individual that they would turn to. And for me, that was Dave. You know, he...
Federico shifts uncomfortably.
I hope I was sort of help to him. I know, I think I was able to sort of give what I could, and I think everyone did the same.
Taking a reflective moment, Federico hangs his head. A police car speeds along a road at night with its lights flashing. Bethany Haynes, daughter of David Haynes.
I had been at my boyfriend's house that night, and he lives in the middle of nowhere. Next thing I know, there's a knock at the door, and all I can remember is seeing the blue flashing lights reflected in the window. I still didn't click on. I thought I'd done something wrong. I was terrified, thinking, oh, what am I going to tell my mum when I'm in the back of a police car? And then I heard her voice, and my boyfriend said, is it her dad? And my mum said, yeah. And I remember deliberately taking ages to come out of the room because I knew what was going to come and I just didn't want to hear it. And my mum had said to me a video had been released as of your dad.
13th of September 2014, a message to the Allies of America.
My name is David Cawthorn Haynes.
He's kneeling beside Mwazi, who's holding a knife. 1970 to 2014.
It took me months to be able to cry. I didn't feel any kind of sadness. It was anger. And then there was also hope. Hope that the others would get out, such as Alan Henning, Peter Kasich. We all prayed and hoped that they would get out.
So there was public pressure to name this individual, but we knew that if we were to name Mwazi, there was a high risk that he would conduct more murders and more beheadings of hostages.
In James Foley's video, obviously, Stephen Sotloff was featured at the end.
The life of this American citizen, Obama, depends on your next decision.
Then the next video, it's my dad, and then the one after it was Alan.
General Sir Richard Barons.
At the time that Jihadi John had killed his third hostage, all you're able to see then is that this is the third, and how many more of these are there going to be?
You had the sequence of increasingly grisly videos. They were very, very skillful propaganda. They recreated the medieval barbarity of the 7th century with these great bladed weapons, the beheadings. It was all on the sands of the desert. And the world's media, I'm afraid, fell for it.
Images were released showing the beheading of American journalist James Foley.
Today, the entire world is appalled.
It is an act of murder.
The video is too graphic for us to show.
And it also sort of speaks to how barbaric and gruesome this can all be.
All eyes are on his eyes.
Again, speaking in English with a British accent.
I recognized John, for sure. The John I met, the Beatle. I recognize his voice. I recognize his style.
People across this country will have been sickened by the fact that it could have been a British citizen. A British citizen who could have carried out this unspeakable act.
And if you look at Mwazi as an adversary, he certainly wasn't a glorious battlefield commander. He wasn't that. He wasn't high in the ISIS hierarchy, such as it was, but he was a powerful, incredible adversary nonetheless. Why? He was from us. He was of us. And so he knew us instinctively.
3rd of October, 2014.
The blood of David Haynes was on your hands, Cameron. Alan Henning will also be slaughtered. But his blood is on the hands of the British Parliament.
Alan Henning, 1967 to 2014.
With each video, there was a sense of this is getting slightly out of control. How is it that we are losing the power dynamic here?
This is Mwazi telling the world about not just what the Islamic State think of America and Britain. This is Mohammed Mwazi telling the world what he thinks about Britain and America. This is his very own personal message, and the venomous tone and the snarling attacks on Obama and Cameron, I think, are very much Mohammed Mwazi.
How can I get treated like this, you know? I'm a British citizen, and my government is threatening me and throwing allegations towards me. I thought this is all a joke now.
David Cameron, along with President Obama, were named in the videos over the next few months. It was very personally directed at them.
I'm back, Obama, and I'm back because of your arrogant foreign policy towards Islamic State.
How else could he be on a par with talking to the President of the United States?
One thing we can all agree on is that a group like ISIL has no place in the 21st century.
The next ISIS video comes out. The next ISIS beheading comes out. Jihadi John's on TV again. You know, Bakr al-Baghdadi said this. You know, all these articles. So there was this wave of information. It seemed like we were losing. Now, I'll tell you, we never were losing in my mind. But it sure did seem that way at a few points.
Civil society will be asking its government, well, why is this happening? And what does it mean for our relationships with our fellow citizens of different faiths? So whatever the substance of these issues, this is just one man doing brutal things in another part of the world. The effect on politics and society is profound.
The Prime Minister made it very clear that we had a responsibility to these British citizens. He took it as a high priority and instructed us to take it as a high priority.
GCHQ from the air.
For us, GCHQ, this was a largely desk, screen-based campaign. In Afghanistan, we could climb up towers and do all the things you need to do on the ground. None of that was possible in Raqqa. If you looked at a picture of Raqqa, you would see these little VSAT terminals, so little satellite dishes, all over the roofs. And they were connecting direct to the internet in practice. And that's the way that people were communicating. They were not using telephone company GSM networks because they didn't trust them.
Mohammed Amwazi, look, he'd been reading the newspaper and watching TV just like the rest of us. He knows that we're coming after him. He went to great lengths to prevent being captured.
He was an interesting case because he had studied computer science and he had been in the IT business, clearly taught himself a lot. He understood, therefore, the best way to avoid surveillance and was good at it. He communicated very rarely, and when he did, mostly around the hostages, he used a whole series of commercially available products to obscure his identity, including very strong encryption and including the virtual private networks. Any one of those products would be very, very difficult for an agency to tackle. What he was doing was layering them on top of each other. Any agency's ambition, if they can find the machine that a terrorist is using, is to put something onto it which will stay there and communicate back what that person is doing. What Amwazi was able to do was to ensure that every time he switched off his machine, it was wiped of anything and everything. And that made it extremely difficult and very, very time-consuming to do anything, really, with his communications. It's never straightforward, and it can take a very, very long time. And in this case, of course, it did take a long time.
16th of November.
Obama, you have started your aerial bombardment in Sham, so it's only right we continue to strike the necks of your people.
That attracted the concern of non-Muslims that are also looking for a reason to denounce Islam. If anybody wants to point to Islam as a religion that breeds barbarity, it's Jihadi John is a complete perfect example, as I was back in the day. But this was an exorbitant level of violence. This was a level of violence unseen before.
Robert Hannigan.
I think these things always escalate. So they started very brutal anyway, frankly. The first execution video, although it stopped short of showing the actual beheading, was horrific in its own way. But as time went on, for whatever reason, they must have decided to take that self-censorship away. Possibly the worst was the execution by Amwazi and others of a whole range of Syrian Air Force officers.
Today, we're slaughtering the soldiers of Bashar, and tomorrow we'll be slaughtering your soldiers.
You hear it all the time. Muslims are the ones who are most targeted by these groups. They're the ones most deeply affected. These groups have operated for over 40 years within Muslim-majority countries. It's only in the last 20 years that it started to affect the West so directly. So these guys aren't here to help the Muslim communities, like they say. And if you needed any kind of reminder of that, then their propaganda videos of violence was there to show you that.
What Jihadi John did, in my opinion, for the first time, help ordinary Muslim to say, wow, there is something that is not right.
By being able to engage in something so unthinkable, you attracted worldwide media, you were the complete concentration of the entire international community. You also made it much easier for people to accept the fact that the state you claim to be defending should be dismantled and should be bombed from above, and it should incorporate a coalition against you. So as a former propagandist, I would say it was completely counterproductive.
Missiles are loaded onto a fighter plane.
What did Mohammed Amwazi mean to those who were fighting the fight against the Islamic State? This hunt for Jihadi John was personal. And his nationality mattered not one whit. For us, this was as personal as if he'd have been an American citizen. What we needed to do was find, fix, and finish Amwazi.
A very, very important target. And ultimately, of course, as they say in the manhunt business ended up on the X.
Very broadly, there are three phases. The first is just gathering intelligence about this person. Based on that, there is then a phase in which you hope to build up a pattern of life. You need a certain regularity to understand their behavior and where they're going to be on a particular day. You also need to make decisions about the deployment of aerial assets, because so much of this is about reconnaissance from above.
We start to realize we think we know exactly where he is. So have a drone take a look at that spot.
A drone takes off and soars above the desert.
We'd been very clear that we had intended to minimize civilian casualties as we prosecuted this fight against ISIS. Jihadi John was able to read between the lines. And he understood that if he surrounded himself with civilians, with non-combatants, that we would be very reticent to try to strike him.
And this boy knew if he had any hope for survival, he had to blend in to the citizens of Raqqa. He had to look from a distance just like them. It's no longer looking for a needle in a haystack. This is like looking for a needle in a stack of needles.
I think where you have any target who is very good at communication security, they are almost always made vulnerable by others that they communicate with, so those around them.
Throughout his life, Mohammed Mwazi had wanted a family. He pursued two engagements, one woman in London, one in Kuwait. It was the one desire which he continued to pursue in Syria. It turned out to be his greatest weakness.
You know, his family was a little bit of a vulnerability, right? He had his, I think, ISIS-issued wife that he got when he was in Syria.
And he knew that he was a target and he'd taken appropriate action. But the one thing he couldn't do, the one thing he wasn't prepared to do, was to not spend time with his family. Once he had established a family in Raqqa, they knew where to find him. They didn't need to track him 24/7. They just had to watch the family and simply wait for him to turn up.
He was very careful about his actions. But you know what? They all slip up eventually. Every one of these guys, to a one, you know, including the most famous one, Osama bin Laden, they all make a mistake. And when they do, we kill them.
12th of November, 2015. A drone flying over the desert banks to the left. A communication center with large monitors displaying maps.
So eventually we acquire our target. We're fairly certain that it's Jihadi John, and we see him, along with some colleagues, enter into a vehicle. So the location is Raqqa. We believed at the time that he was heading to the city center. And this goes on for some time. You know, he's driving around for, I don't know, it might have been 45. It was a while.
The drone's camera tracks Simwazi's vehicle as it drives through the streets of Raqqa.
Inside of that ops center, the hunt for Jihadi John was fairly routine. For me personally, I was more invested. You know, he was my foe. I had been trading blows with him for months at this point. So, you know, as we're following him around, what we're really looking for is an opportunity to strike him. You might be able to see an area, but perhaps the missile can't negotiate around the various buildings or population density. So we're trying to find the opportune time to take the shot. Because remember, if you shoot and miss, well, guess what? Now he knows. Now he knows that we're shooting at him. And sure enough, eventually, he moves his vehicle into a relatively open area that, in fact, ISIS had used previously for executions. Sort of a little poetic justice, I guess. His vehicle stops, and we see a figure exit the vehicle. We don't know what he's doing, but we did know that this is not a bad little location here. He steps out of the vehicle. And now we have an opportunity to really try to triple check that this is Jihadi John. Because of the conditions, it was night, we're using infrared, you can't see his face. But we could sort of see how he moved, the cut of his jib, so to speak, you know, the angle of his beard, you know, these things we could see. Eventually, we were convinced that this is Jihadi John. And so the floor commander at the time orders, take the shot.
They fire the missile.
Then that missile's in flight. And the missile can fly anywhere from, I don't know, 5 to 15 seconds. And that really is kind of the most tense moment, because now that missile's gone, you can't take it back. And so you have these moments, it's all done, and you don't know what's going to happen next.
Mwazi's car's parked on an open stretch of road in the desert, with no other vehicles or buildings near it. The car is in the drone's crosshairs as the missile strikes and blows it up, sending a huge, flaming cloud of smoke into the air. The cloud of smoke slowly dissipates skyward and reveals a smouldering crater where the vehicle used to be.
You might ask, you know, was there high-fiving and celebration after this? And counterintuitively, the answer is no. This is the serious business of eradicating an existential threat by taking a human life.
I don't rejoice at anyone's death, but it was certainly a good thing that he was no longer able to do the really brutal and disgusting things that we'd seen on video.
And yes, you could argue that, you know, Mwazi's departure lethally and instantaneously was perhaps unsatisfying. It wasn't a 10-minute execution. He didn't have to feel the cut of the steel.
I had a mixed feeling. Of course, I would have preferred to see him in court, facing his charges and being blamed for and answering for the crimes he committed. It was mixed feeling, but the main feeling, though, was the satisfaction, the relief, at least. This person will not harm anyone anymore.
But in that instant, I was well aware that there are plenty of other people who would step into his shoes. It would have been strange to see this as a massive breakthrough. It was a part of one particular story, but the ISIL threat went on. We're going to have to live with a level of extreme Islamist violence for some time to come. And it will continue to inspire people in Western countries.
What you have are horrendous terrorist acts, all attributed to ISIS. Abu Bakr Baghdadi had not a clue that any of those things were going to happen. But he didn't have to. What they got was inspiration, and that's all they needed.
U.S.-led airstrikes are hitting the heart of ISIS-controlled territory in Syria.
A coalition of nations has come together, and Britain has to do its share.
Of withering airstrikes on ISIS targets.
Proclamations of victory over Group in both Iraq and Syria.
A secret deal reportedly allowed some of the most notorious ISIS fighters to escape from a besieged Syrian city.
They made an agreement so that they didn't literally have to destroy Raqqa to save it. I'm sure that was the least bad of the options. Now what you're seeing already is the remnants of these forces turning into insurgent groups. These are elusive enemies now. They're no longer wearing uniforms or flying black flags. They are hiding among the population. So this is going to be a very different threat. I'm very confident that ultimately Baghdadi will find himself on the X as well.
Once some of the world's most wanted, but now nobody wants them. The last two of the British ISIS cell, dubbed the Beatles, jailed in Syria. How they'll face justice is now a matter of hot debate. Accused of waterboarding, crucifixion, accessory to beheadings of Western hostages.
The Beatles, they are obsessed with their own self-image. They have gone from capturing Western journalists to now trying to capture Western journalists' attention, turning their stories around as if they were victims. And it's caused quite an interesting reaction to what do we do with people like that.
I would expect to attend the trial. And what is of prime importance to me is that this trial is fair. We should not give them any chance to portray themselves as victims. We are the victim. They are the perpetrators. They are the terrorists.
We need to have the courage to have a higher standard. We must not debase ourselves to the level of hatred that they have.
I never ever told my dad how proud I was of him. It's only now, when he's not here, that I realise how proud I actually was.
I mean, David was always talking to his daughters. He'd have his time when he just wanted to speak to his daughters.
Frederico and I, we were kind of forced together through this.
Yeah, we speak often. She's remarkably like her father in temperament and in many ways. I definitely see a lot of David in her.
When people tell me I'm a lot like my dad, I used to always think, oh, I don't believe it. So when he says, oh, you're so much like your dad, it really does ring true, and you think, well, I must be doing something right.
There was a sense in which Mwazi had fulfilled his ambitions, but there was also some self-analysis by us as to whether we'd actually had the right strategy for this individual. On the one hand, we had absolutely understood the threat he posed, but ultimately we failed because he became what he wanted to be, potentially one of the worst terrorists of all time.
To think that the level of hatred that must have been generated over that short number of years was such that it would have inspired him to behave in the way that he did, I find that incredible. That's not the same person that I knew.
He was a guy who had it all. British passport, safety and security, all the benefits of British society. He had a future. He was the guy that had it all, and he gave it up for the Islamic State.
Somebody put it very strikingly. They said the terrorist is like the fly in the china shop. Now, he can't destroy the china shop on his own. The fly isn't nearly strong enough. But if he gets inside the ear of a bull, then the bull, if it panics, will destroy the china shop. We're the bull, they're the fly. That's why it's important not to panic.
Ultimately, it's a battle of ideas, and I am confident that good ideas with the right support will demonstrate that bad ideas are nihilistic. They destroy themselves and others. Now, that's part of the battle that's going on right now for the heart and soul of Islam.
And as part of Jim's legacy, we want to inspire young people to care and do good things in the world. We need that goodness.
A long and straight road stretches out towards the horizon, flanked on either side by a vast, arid desert.